Shalom Aleichem, Chevra. We are about to begin conference call number 6 with Rabbi Willig. Rebbe, please begin.
Thank you very much. Question number 1. I have developed a relationship with a couple from the local conservative synagogue. The husband is Jewish, and the wife had a conservative conversion. She shows a lot more interest than he does. How should I view her status? Assuming that we view her as a non-Jew, should I try to connect to her and convince her to go through an Orthodox conversion? The question is very simple, but the answer is very complex. My understanding of the question is, this couple is staying together, and then the obvious ideal solution was to do a proper conversion. I note that the questioner uses two terms, conservative conversion and Orthodox conversion. We like to use the term proper conversion or halachically valid conversion. So obviously, if the man is staying with this lady who's not Jewish at the present time, because we consider conservative conversions, we presume, are not valid. So the proper thing to do would be to convert her properly. But not just because it's an Orthodox conversion. She goes to an Orthodox conversion with an Orthodox rabbi without fulfillment of the mitzvahs, acceptance and fulfillment of the mitzvahs. This conversion itself is highly questionable. Now, much ink has been spilled about the issue of conversions without full acceptance and performance of the mitzvahs of the Torah. We cannot go into the entire lengthy discussion. But suffice it to say that there are a number of tshuvas in Igros Moshe which require some explanation and which shed light on our particular case. In Igros Moshe, Chelek Aleph Yerodea, a number of tshuvas on this topic. The first one, Kuf Nun Zayin, written back in Europe, a ger did not accept mitzvahs. From Moshe Paskins, it's worthless. The fact that he said he's in the Kabbalah mitzvahs, if it is an anan sade, if we are witnesses, she'ena mekabel of emetz, that's not really true what he's saying, eino klum, it's zero. Zero, it doesn't mean anything. The person is still completely not Jewish. That's written in 1928 back in Europe. There were two consecutive tshuvas, both written in 1950 here in America. They are Kuf Nun Tes and Kuf Samach. Rav Moshe writes, if a man converts for the sake of marriage, Kimat Barur Kanan Tzadei Shelo Mekabeles Mitzvahs, the woman in this case, Rakvapia Omeres Shemekabeles, Uvelo Kabolas Mitzvahs Af Rak Prat Echad, Mefurish Negemara and Bechoras Af Lamed, you would not accept such an individual. He uses an expression, Kimat Barur Kanan Tzadei, it's almost for sure that there's no sincere Kabolas Mitzvahs. True, Rav Moshe goes on, the Gemara speaks in Masechta Shabbos, Daf Sanuches, a person converts amongst Goyim and doesn't know about Shabbos, perhaps even Avodah Zarah, he's considered to be a ger because he accepts whatever he believes Bnei Yisrael have to keep, even if he's unaware of precisely what all those mitzvos are. But, go back to Rav Moshe, Rov Geirus Shebe Medina Zu, most conversions in America, Shebe Shvil Ishus, for the sake of marriage, Ein Mekablin HaMitzvahs, There's no acceptance of mitzvahs. Avksha omer v'pien shemekablin. They say it. We don't know the kenodah shemeramin. They're fooling us. Holote adifa mibala. She, the non-Jewish woman, is not going to be any better than her husband. She mufku v'overal kol dinei haTorah. He's not from. He's violating all the laws of the Torah. Maybe this particular woman is an exception, and she'll accept the mitzvahs. And now a sociological observation. The many rabbanim in New York accept these geirus, and therefore, ain li loma bazeh isurin. I'm not going to say anything, but ain dati nocha. I'm not happy with these conversions. So, somewhat ambiguous statement, that even though he said before with no Kabbalah's mitzvahs is worthless, since there's an outside chance, maybe a fluke, this woman will really be accepting the mitzvahs, notwithstanding the fact that her husband is not from at all. So, I don't like it. Someone does it. I'm not going to say it's usher. Strange. If it's invalid, so then it should be usher. You are abetting an intermarriage, which otherwise might not happen. So the answer to that question is found in the very next Shuvah. Shuvah Kuf Samach, also in 1950. Rav Moshe says, people have this problem. Conversions which are not really sincere. What's the case? She converted for someone to marry someone who's Mechal Shabbos. The Bezdin told her she has to keep Shabbos. But she thinks it's only a Chumrah Shabbos. She thinks that someone doesn't keep Shabbos is a good Jew. So Moshe says, well, maybe there's a possibility that the Geirus is good. This contradicts the previous Shuvah. We said the Geirus is no good. Perhaps the answer is as follows. He's writing here what they call a limud zchus. A limud zchus, he's trying to defend a little bit on the Rabbanim and Mekabalim. They shouldn't be worse than Hedyotos. Maybe they think that Shmir Shabbos is really not required. Maybe. So therefore, if she converted, maybe the conversion is good. He thinks it's probably not good. But in the case of someone who accepts zero, nothing, then the Geirus certainly is no good. Now we come to the amazing punchline, which talks to our case. Moshe writes to a rabbi in Canton, Ohio, far away. I quote, "Uluhaba vaday tov sheyifo kvodo sheyizgayu etzel rava yodea bedine geiris vosikidin." These individuals who are intermarrying in any event, better they should convert with an Orthodox rabbi. Av shagam heim safek im nechshu geim kiliel. It's very doubtful that they're really Jewish. Do it anyway. What about someone wants to marry this person? V'tov laharchik mehem et shomei Torah. An incredible tshuva. Rav Moshe is saying, as I understand it, they're intermarrying anyway. They're going to marry a Jewish man anyway. If the conversion is conservative, Rav Moshe writes explicitly in such a case, that conversion is zero. Because conservative rabbis are not kosher dayanim. If she converts with an Orthodox rabbi, then as long as there's some change in her behavior, something, it's at least a doubt. Maybe they're Jewish, most likely they're not. Since they're marrying someone Jewish anyway, it's worthwhile going through the conversion of the Orthodox auspices. Rav Moshe's psak is close to the question that we're being asked over here. Here she's already, quote-unquote, married to a Jewish person, Moshe would say, better to do a doubtful conversion, we'll call it here an Orthodox conversion, as long as she will keep some of the mitzvahs, rather than do no conversion, but she's completely not Jewish, notwithstanding her conservative conversion. This is Igros Moshe. A rabbi who developed a relationship with a couple from the local conservative synagogue and wants to rely on Rav Moshe's psak has the right to do so. Whether this psak should be followed in broader terms is very doubtful. If you look in the tshuva of Rav Chaim Oizer on issues of geirus, he also is discussing a case of someone who's insincere, and his expression is that his geirus is doubtful, and he ends, "Ein osin safek biyodayim lechatchila." We don't create doubtful converts lechatchila. Rav Moshe would agree with that. He's not discussing lechatchila. He's discussing b'diavad. They're marrying Jewish anyway. This lady's quote married Jewish anyway. But that requires a local decision of the Rav to decide whether it's appropriate to follow this guideline and create a Suffolk convert instead of someone who's not converted, assuming that a conservative is no good, as Rav Moshe assumes. Or to say, no, I don't want to get involved in conversions in which the non-Jewish individual walks around with a piece of paper with my name on it, even though I can't vouch for it. I'm supposed to tell B'nai Torah not to marry her. That's a bit of a complex question which requires an on-site evaluation. Circumstances can vary. So again, there is a basis for doing an Orthodox conversion, even if it's not 100% good. It's a very big suffix, whether it is good, probably not good. There's a basis in Igros Moshe. A Rav who feels he doesn't want to have his name on a conversion that he really cannot vouch for and he should tell B'nai Torah to stay away from, should not be getting involved in this kind of a circumstance. End of question one. Question two. Eruvin. I'm asked to discuss Karpaf. A Karpaf is what's called Eina Muka Fadira. That's not meant for living purposes. And a number of examples are found here. 8 questions are thrown. The first is called Public Parks. The Me'iri writes in Eruvin Daf Chavdal and Amin Aleph that an area which is the same Noi V'Til, meant for beauty and for hiking and walking there, is called Mukaf L'Dira. It's called living, and therefore there's no problem of Karpaf whatsoever. Yes, it's true that there are Achronim who are strict. The beautiful Sefer called Nesiva Shabbos, Rabbi Beloy is Achronim Lebrach of Yerushalayim, in Perek Yud Gimel, Ha'orah Mem Dal, he says all those who disagree with the Me'iri didn't see what he wrote. It wasn't printed yet. But now that we have the Me'iri, there's much room to be lenient in the public park, which is meant for beauty and walking and hiking therein. B is more complex. Woods contained in a public park. If one can walk in the woods, then it's no problem. The same as the park itself. If not, then, in fact, it is a karpaf. What's the halachic status of a karpaf in and of itself? Once it's more than a certain minimal amount, based on sayim, which is 50 by 100 amos, not so much, one may not carry in it. What if you have a large city, and in the middle of that large city, there's a little wooded area, more than the 50 by 100? So the bir halacha and simin shin nun ches siftes, Dibra Masal Aval quotes the famous Dvar Shmuel, who says that this area will not ruin the entire city's Eruv. And therefore, while perhaps he shouldn't be carrying in the wooded area where you wouldn't walk in there anyway, it will not ruin the city Eruv. In that same beautiful Sefer Nesivos Shabbos footnote Nun, he quotes many people on both sides of this issue. And the custom apparently is to be lenient. So therefore, in the average case of a city, there's room to be lenient based upon the Dvar Shmuel, although there are those who disagree. What about lakes in a public park? So, the Shulchan Aruch talks about it. Water if the water is drinkable, it's okay. The Sharatian, Shin and Ches, Os Pealov says, if it's usable in any other way, the water is used for laundry purposes, it's okay. Many people say it's if you can row on it or swim in it. As long as people are using it, it would be okay. But if not, we go back to the Dvar Shmuel of before, according to most authorities. Woods on a private land. Now, in that same footnote, Nun, he quotes some Toskim who say that if it's private land, there's no din of karpa, it's muta no matter what. If not, if you don't accept that opinion, you go back to the question of whether you can walk there or not. If you can walk there, it's fine. If not, then you have to rely on the Dvar Shmuel. Same applies to access allowed to the public. If they can walk through the woods, it's no problem. If they just can walk around it, then it would be a problem, again, relying on the Dvar Shmuel. F is golf courses. Well, that seems to be the same as public parks. It's made for teal and for noi. According to the Miri, it's not a problem. Cemeteries. That same Sefer in footnote Mem Aleph, he says that if there's no guard who lives in the cemetery, it's prohibited, the same as the Zeroyim. And we have back to the Dvar Shmuel, who would permit it in the case in which the cemetery is exposed. If it is surrounded by a fence, then you may not carry in the cemetery, but you may carry throughout the city. According to the Dvar Shmuel, it would always be permissible on the grounds that it's within the city. You could carry outside the cemetery, but not inside. If the people have it, it's a tourist attraction, that might be considered dira, tourists are coming there, but of course, they're not coming so regularly, so that's still a question. This ends question two. Question three. What is the halachic status of the Chasam Sofer statement, Chodesh Osim in HaTorah? If it is a binding statement, what are its gedorim? We all know this is just what we call in our language a melitza, a figure of speech. Chodesh means new grain. And he uses an expression to mean that everything that is introduced by the reformers of this day that were undermining the halach Judaism, is awesome in HaTorah. That's what the Chasam Sofer meant. There are a number of scholarly articles about it in various publications, which can easily be accessed. I don't want to go into what it said there. I'd rather discuss the issue itself. We spoke about it last time, that there are chidushim. Chodesh is not automatically awesome in HaTorah. And Gdolei HaTorah are those who are authorized to introduce these chidushim into Klal Yisrael. And the purpose of these chidushim, as we mentioned last time, is to preserve the Mesorah. We gave examples of the Chafetz Chaim's radical chidush to endorse Torah study for women communally, which had never been done before. But a chiddush, the shame chiddush, something new because it's new, against the Mesorah and against the Gedolei Rabbanim, is in fact Osam and HaTorah, as the Chasam Sofer said, because it undermines the Mesorah. Now, of course, you understand very well that times and places can change. What's prohibited in one place can be permissible and even advisable in another place, in another time. I'll just give one example. It's quoted that the Chazon Ish encouraged the schools in his area to teach in Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, which the children understood better. And they told them that in Yerushalayim, the old Yishuv, they fought the Milchama against this. You have to teach in Yiddish, you may not teach in Hebrew. So the Chazon Ish responded, in any battlefield, in any war, the front moves from place to place. They're fighting a battle on a front which doesn't exist over here. We're in different circumstances. You have to always know where the front is, where battle lines should be drawn, and where changes are not only permissible, but even advisable. The Chazon Ish, one of the greatest Gedolim, took on himself the understanding that to teach in Hebrew would be preferable in his time and his place to teaching in Yiddish, which was done before. Small little example, but shows you that there can be changes, but only with the endorsement and the encouragement and the unambiguous support of Gedolei Torah in that time and place. Otherwise, we go back to the Chasam Sofer's Melitza, and I only meant it as a Melitza, figure of speech, of Chodesh Asur Min HaTorah. Of course, this has great relevance into today's world, but that we spoke about already last time. Question number 4. In my community and outside, Hashkacha is now endorsing just the bagels in the local non-kosher bagel store as kosher dairy. What should my stance be? It would be very unpopular to speak straight out and tell them not to buy there. Some congregants are encouraging me to, as a local Rav, take over the Hashkacha. After all, it's just bagels. What should we do? Now, there's a very important problem over here. A kosher milchik bagel is an oxymoron. Can't be. Says in Yerodeya Simen Tzadi Zion, if you have a bread and there's dairy in it, it's not kosher. Not kosher with parf, not kosher with milchiks, of course not with fleshiks. Chazal made a special gzera against, we'll call it milchik bread, so you should not mistakenly consume meat with that milchik bread. There's no way, that I know, to give ashkacha on a bagel to be kosher and dairy, with the possible exception that the dairy is batel b'shishim. Then you would label it dairy for various reasons, whether they be legal / allergy reasons, or just to be transparent. But halachically would be considered parf. But if it is really dairy, that means more than 1 in 60 parts milk product, it's prohibited by strict halacha, and even if it's unpopular, you have to just say, I'm sorry, but it's prohibited. Question number 5. What is the right way to educate our Balei Tshuva? Should a Balei Tshuva be advised to adopt the minhagim of the area where his family originated from? And examples are given, washing before Kiddush, waiting 3 hours, standing for Kiddush, or follow the minhag of his Rebbe, which is minhag hamakom. An excellent question. Strictly speaking, the minhagim of our ancestors in Europe no longer apply to us automatically because they are defined as minhag hamakom. Those makomas are no longer populated. When someone moves across the ocean, he's no longer bound by minhagim of his ancestors. You'll say, what about minhag avos? So minhag avos is a very nice thing, not against it, but it's not, strictly speaking, binding. We have a concept of minhag hamakom, yes, that is binding, but minhag avos is not binding. So, we go back to this original question. Is there a minhag hamakom on these matters? In most of our cities, there's no minhag kavua with respect to any of these three. The Kiddush, some sit and some stand. Some wash before, some wash after. Some wait 6 hours, some wait 3 hours. So what is this Baal Tshuva to do? So if, in fact, there is a makom, which is his Rebbe's makom, it's not the city. The city has all kinds of people. But he feels he is now joined a particular group and likely to remain somehow connected to that particular group, he should be advised to follow the minhag of that group. I think it's a superior minhag than the minhag of his ancestors, wherever they happen to be in Europe in such matters, because those minhagim are no longer binding. They were forgotten even within his family. And now he's probably better off holding on to the minhag of his Rebbe or his makom, if those are the same, than searching out his original roots to see what the minhag was. If, on the other hand, he has no particular minig rebbe or minig makom. He just follows whatever's going on. Perhaps he should be advised to go back to his roots. In terms of these three menagim in particular, it seems to me that the preferred minig is to follow what we'll call the majority minig, the more prevailing minig in the city that he inhabits. From what I could tell, the vast majority of the observant Jews in our communities wait 6 hours as opposed to a small minority who wait 3 hours. Significant majority wash after Kiddush, notwithstanding the Ramos Psak to the contrary. And from what I've been able to observe, most people these days stand for Kiddush, perhaps because they come from a Hasidic background. But those are the majority, again, in declining order of majorities. 6 hours is the greatest majority. Washing after Kiddush, still, I believe, a significant majority. And with respect to the standing and sitting for Kiddush, it's much closer. I think that the majority are standing these days. And I would advise to keep those menhagim in the absence of a specific need to follow the minhag of his mokum / rebbe, or the absence of his knowledge or his inclination to go back to the minhag of his avos from Europe, since it's not binding from strict halach. Question number 6. Often shuls have an extra reading of Parshas Zachar for women, parentheses, and for men who came very late. What is the proper procedure? Does it need to be a minyan in shul when this is done? So the number of factors that come into play over here, there are those rabbonim who are opposed to any such reading of the Torah with a Parshas Zachar, with or without 10 people in the room, since the official Kriyas HaTorah is over and no bracha is going to be made. They're opposed to taking out a Sefer Torah without making a bracha for a variety of reasons. I believe Rav Moshe is of that opinion. However, in many, if not most shuls, they do take out the Sefer Torah and read. The objective is, of course, for women. It could happen that a man comes late. It's possible, but we're going to focus on the issue of women, since it's much more common. So now, there's a problem. The Rosh writes in Brochus in the 7th Perek, Simen Chof, quote, Lo mistabrili de mari v'asara d'oraisa k'gon likos parsha zocha shumen ha-Torah. Sounds like you need a minyan by Torah law for parsha zocha. You don't know where it came from. But nonetheless, if such a rush exists, you have to worry about it in our context. So perhaps we can explain the requirement for a minyan as follows. The Gemara Sanhedrin and Avchof says that there are three mitzvahs when we come into Eretz Yisrael: appointing a king, destroying Amalek, and building the Beis HaMikdash. The Chinuch writes, this is mutal al tzibur kulo. And only one who is obligated to fight against Amalek is obligated to fulfill Zechiras Amalek. We can therefore say as follows. If we fulfill Zechiras Amalek in Parsha Zohar, it can only be fulfilled b'tzibur. Every person is required to hear it because he's a part of the tzibur. If there aren't 10 people there, there's no tzibur, and it's impossible to fulfill the mitzvah Parsha Zachar min haTorah. It's a Torah halacha, as the Rosh implies, of having a minyan, because it's a mitzvah hamutalas ala tzibur, as the Chinuch writes, and therefore it requires the tzibur to remember Amalek, as the Chinuch wrote with respect to actually destroying Amalek. It's a mitzvah hatzibur. That's a possible explanation of what the Rosh seems to imply, that you have to have 10 people to hear Parsha Zohar. The Chinuch there, Mitzvah Tuf Reish Dalet, however, exempts women from the Mitzvah Aseh of Zechiras Amalek completely. Why? They're not benos milchama. They're not benos milchama. Minchas Chinuch asks, but a woman is supposed to go out to milchemes mitzvah, kala michuposa, so did af memdalet. We can say that they go out to cook, as the Rashash writes there in Sota. They don't go out to actually fight. Nonetheless, Minchas Chinuch has another problem. Maybe hearing and remembering Masa Amalek has nothing to do with the obligation to destroy Amalek. Maybe even when Mashiach comes and Amalek is destroyed, there'll be a Mishnah to remember Amalek. And therefore women should be obligated precisely for this reason that many women come to Shul and Parshas Zohar. Of course, the question becomes, but there's no minyan. And the Rosh said, if there's no minyan, even midoraisa, it's possible you did not fulfill the mitzvah. Seems to me, however, that we can explain the minyan that we have, that women come and hear Parshas Zohar without a minyan, as follows. The only reason to require 10 people, as we said before, is because the mitzvah of Zechira is based on the mitzvah of Milchama, which is the Chinuch writes, is Mutal ala Tzibur, and then Zechira too must take place for Tzibur. According to that opinion, women are exempt from Parshas Zohar completely, as the Chinuch wrote. But according to those who say that women are chayev in the Torah, you must say, as the Minchas Chinuch does, that Zechira is a separate and distinct obligation, which has nothing to do with the Milchama against Amalek. Well, if it's a separate and distinct obligation having nothing to do with the Milchama against Amalek, then you would not require 10 men. So Meman of Shach, if it's an obligation which is communal in nature, women are exempt completely. They're not obligated to fight a war against Amalek, and if the connection between Zohar and fighting wars exists, they're potter from Parshas Zohar too. If you want to view Zechira Samalek as an independent, freestanding mitzvah with nothing to do with wiping out Amalek, then women may in fact be obligated. However, that independent obligation of Zechira, nothing to do with the mitzvah of Mechira Samalek proper, would be a private, individualized mitzvah, not a communal mitzvah. And therefore women, if they're chayav in it, according to this side of the chakira, would not require 10 men to be in the room when they fulfill the mitzvah. That is how I explain our custom. Of course, if I'm right, if a man would walk in so late and would want to fulfill Parshas Zohar, should make sure that there are 10 men in the room when he is reading or hearing Parshas Zohar. This is question 6A. 6B. When there is an extra reading of the Megillah by a man for a woman, what bracha should be made? If the reading is only for women, should one of the women make the bracha? So this is clearly a question which is discussed in the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Megillah. And the following is found in the Shulchan Aruch, in Simen, Tof Reish Pei Tes. Shulchan Aruch writes as follows. It's important to get the full background over here. It has a little to do with our discussion of last time. In Sif Beis, Shulchan Aruch writes, Yesh Omrim Shehanoshim Einam Motzios Esho Anoshim. There are some who say that a woman cannot read the Megillah for a man. Why? So the main reason is given to the Mishnah Berurah. The main reason is, Isha ena chayeves bekriya rak lishmoa. She's not obligated to read the Megillah, only to hear the Megillah. And therefore, she's ena mechayeves bedavar with respect to the ish, to a man who is obligated in Kriya. And then it says, a woman can read for another woman, technically, but the Magen Avraham says she shouldn't even read for herself, based upon the Zohar, etc. Now, Kamzer Ramo, V'yesh Omrim, V'ma'isha Koro Li'atzma, V'varechas Lishmoa Megillah, She'ena Chayeves B'kriya. Different brachas made, Lishmoa Megillah. If you look in Mishnah Brura, when he phrased it, Lishmoa Mikra Megillah, he added a word. Some say, Al Mishma Megillah. Three different versions of the bracha that should be made, but they all have this shoresh of Shomea as opposed to Kore. And there are many shuls where, in fact, this is the custom, that the bracha for a woman has the verb of Shmia in one of the three forms, as opposed to Al Mikra Megillah, which is said for the men. Who actually makes the bracha? Here too, there is a matter of dispute. Should the man make the bracha if he's reading for the women? Or should a woman make the bracha? Again, there are different customs. In many places that I know, a woman makes the bracha for herself and all of her friends who are listening to the Megillah. I believe that's the more prevalent custom, even though there are those who say that the man can and perhaps even should make the bracha. I'd like to analyze a little bit this unusual halacha over here, make a different bracha for women as opposed to the bracha made for men. It's hard for us to understand at first glance why this should be so. But to understand this, we have to go back to the original din, that a woman cannot read the Megillah for a man. The source, as you probably are aware, is the Baal Halachos Gedolos, quoted by the Rosh, briefly in Tosfos, the Masechta Megillah, Daf Dalet, and they throw in the idea of Shmiya versus Kriya. What does that mean? What do they mean? So there are three classical Perushim and Achronim. The Turi Evan says that although women are obligated because Afein Hoyav Oso Anes, that's only rabbinic, but a man is chayav what we call midivrei Kabbalah based on the words of the Megillah itself, which is a higher level. The Marcheshes says that Megillah has an aspect of Hallel, Kriyasa Zuhilula, Megillah Daf Yudalem and Aleph. Woman is putter from Hallel, so she cannot just help a man fulfill the obligation of Hallel. And the Or Sameach, back to the Chinuch we mentioned before, as a woman is putter from Zechiras Amalek, and as such, she cannot read the Megillah for the man. He's going to lack the dimension of Zechiras Amalek, which inheres in Megillas Esther. If this is correct, and this should not be taken in any way lahalacha, it should emerge, as the Mikroi Kodesh writes in Siman Chav Tes, that at night, when there's no obligation of Divrei Kabbalah, and there's no obligation of Hallel, and probably not of Zechiras Amalek either, a woman in theory could read the Megillah for a man, even according to the Baal Halachos Gedolos. But the problem of Shmiya and Kriya, it seems to be insurmountable. It doesn't fit. So let me give you my explanation, which is based on an Avnei Nezer, Siman Tov Kuf Yud Aleph. He says that Shomea Ka'ona Ein Pirsum Anes B'mashu Ka'ona Kevan Sheze Ein Yodua Lako. Not everyone realizes that Shomea is Ka'ona. Since Kriyas Megillah is Pirsum Anisa, it should be only Shmiya. Only Shmiya. And the reason why is the Kriya, he throws in again Zechiras Amalek. Now we understand what he means. Women are chayav in Shmiya, which is the main core obligation of the Megillah, and not Kriya, which is Parsha Zohar. The problem, of course, becomes we should make a bracha all on Shmiya Samegillah, especially at night. But we don't do that. We make a bracha on Kriyas and Megillah. So therefore, I'd like to suggest as follows. The real mitzvah of the Megillah is Kriya, al-Mikra Megillah, against the Avnei Nezer. But his assumption is correct. You cannot say Shamei HaKa'ona with respect to Pesumei Nisa, because not everybody realizes, except for the intellectual elite, that the person who's listening is really, in effect, reading it to Shamei HaKa'ona. So therefore, the obligation of Shamei HaKa'ona is limited to Shmia. That is correct. That part is correct. However, in contrast to Avnei Nezer, the suggestion is made that there are two parts to the Megillah. There's the core mitzvah of Megillah, which is Mikra Megillah, Kriya, that's why you make such a bracha. And there's the Pesumei Nisa aspect of Megillah, which by definition must be Shmia, because we would not apply the principle of Pesumei Nisa with respect to Shamei HaKa'ona, because it's not famous. Now, women are chayav in the Megillah, why? Af hein hoyu ba'oso hanes. Af hein hoyu ba'oso hanes. A new category of mitzvahs that applies to Megillah and Erech Chanukah and Abakosus. Since we are saying that the mitzvah, the core mitzvah, is Kriyas HaMegillah, and Pesumei Nisa is only Shmiras HaMegillah, we're going to suggest that a woman is only chayav in the Pesumei Nisa aspect of Megillah, which is Shmia. She's exempt from Iker Mitzvahs Megillah, which is Kriya. Why? Because it's the Mitzvah Saseh Shazman Grama. Therefore, the Bahag says a woman cannot read the Megillah for a man. She's only obligated in Shmia, which means Pesumei Nisa. He's obligated in Kriya, which is the core mitzvah. And that's why the Mordechai said you make a bracha on the Shmia, because the woman is only chayav in Shmia, and she's not chayav in Kriya. Oh. There's a problem, though. I want to address the problem directly. We follow Minig Ashkenaz. The Ramah certainly does. Minig Ashkenaz, a woman can make a bracha on shofar, on lulav, on sukkah, as they traditionally do, even though they're not obligated whatsoever. So why do women make a bracha on Shmiras HaMegillah when they can make a bracha on Mikra Megillah, even if they're not obligated in Kriya, even if it is Zman Grama? It's no different than lulav and shofar and sukkah. Now that is an excellent question. I believe the answer is very, very important based on our previous shiur. What exactly is the answer? We have to go back to Rav Yoh. The Rav Yoh writes in Simen Tov Kuf Samach Tes that we have the concept of the Baha Lachas Gedolos that a woman is unable to fulfill the mitzvah of Megillah for a man. He wants to know what would happen with respect to the other two, Arba Kosos and Hadlokas Neros Chanukah. He says, Badakti ba'alokas gedolos, v'lo pirish b'midi, v'lo yadana ba'ibichara machta igel leferushi olo. He wants to know, Chanukah and Arba Kosos, would we also say that a woman's obligation is different from that of a man? This clearly is not would not fit with the traditional Achronim's interpretation of Amalek or Halel or Divrei Kabbalah. Nothing to do with Chanukah or Arba Kosos. Rather, it confirms the shot that we had suggested, that there are two dimensions, Pesumei Nisa and the core mitzvah. To make a very long story very short, in the Megillah, as we said, the core mitzvah is Kriya, but Pesumei Nisa is Shmia, because it's not famous that everybody is reading through Shomei HaKa'ona. And Arba Kosos, also familiar with the Chidushim Moran Riz Halevi Al Rambam, explains, based on the Girsas of Rif Rambam, that Arba Kosos has two dimensions. This is called Cheirus, which is Pirsumei Nisa, just to drink 4 cups of delicious wine in any order at any time. And as we called Arba Kosos, which is Seder Bracha Lakos, which we'll call the core mitzvah. The core mitzvah is to drink 4 cups in conjunction with Kiddush, Haggadah, benching and challah respectively. And the Pirsumei Nisa aspect is drinking 4 delicious cups of wine, but that can even be done Bevas Achas, as Gemara puts in the Masechta Pesachim on the Kuf Chesem Beis. So too with Ner Chanukah. The mitzvah, the core mitzvah is mitzvah Chanukah, Ner Ish Ubeiso. Ner Ish Ubeiso. That everyone is supposed to light. But the Pirsumei Nisa aspect is not the lighting. Just as most people are unaware of the fact that Shomei Ka'ona, most people are unaware of the fact that's Ner Ish Ubeiso. So if you'd ask them, you stop them on the way out of the Megillah, you fulfill the mitzvah, and you'll ask, and they'll say, yes, how? By listening. That's an incomplete answer. They should have said Shomei Ka'ona. If you get a person coming out of his house, Chanukah, and ask him or her, did you fulfill the mitzvah? And they'll say, yes. How'd you do it? They'll respond, what do you mean, how'd I do it? My father, my husband, lit the Ner Chanukah, and I was there, and I watched it, and I sang along, and everything. I answered Amen to the Brachas. That's exactly what the Gemara means in Masechet Shabbos, that someone who's Roa Ner Chanukah makes She'asa Nisim. She'asa Nisim is the Bracha on Pirsumei Nisa. If this is so, then we understand very well that the Rav Yoh wanted to take the Bahag and apply it to Arba Kosos and to Ner Chanukah. I just didn't find it there, but we found reasons and ways to expand the Bahag to these two other mitzvahs, the Vangarama of Pirsumei Nisa. The women are obligated to know about Sanes, namely Ner Chanukah and Arba Kosos. Having said this, the question becomes, and we're going a little bit into Chanukah, the Shulchan Aruch says that perhaps a katan can light a Ner Chanukah for a gadol. My Rebbe explained that Ner Chanukah is Ner Ish Ubeiso, and it's not a personal obligation, and therefore even though a katan cannot read the Megillah for a gadol, despite the fact it's all the Rabbanon, Ner Chanukah works. This explains the obvious question against this interpretation. How can it be that a woman who's unable to read the Megillah for a man is able to light Chanukah for a man, explicitly in the Gemara? Isha vare adlika, afen abos manes. The answer is, it's not a personal obligation, which requires a bar chiyuba on the same level. It's a household obligation, ner ish ubeiso. So since the woman, her ner has halachic meaning, even according to one opinion, a katan shegiya lechinuch, and therefore, the mitzvah is fulfilled by a man if the woman lights a Ner Chanukah. It's interesting, if you look carefully in the Mishnah Berurah, Hilchos Chanukah, quotes from the Ola Shmuel, that says a woman can make a bracha l'hadlik Ner Chanukah, it's the same way as Man Gerama. The obvious question is, what do you mean? Here she's chayev, by Sukkah she's potter. The answer would be according to this, no, the woman is potter from Adlakas Ner Chanukah. She's only chayev in Riyas Ner Chanukah. L'hadlik Ner Chanukah, she's potter. She's only chayev in the Riyah and seeing it, which is Ashas Anissim. But she can volunteer to say the Hadlik the same as she can volunteer to say Leisha Basuka. But now the question becomes, women today make a bracha of the Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. We don't find some special mitzvah, some special text of Liros Ner Chanukah or just Ashas Anissim. But the question is, why is Chanukah different than Megillah? I'd like to explain as follows. It's true, a woman could make a bracha on Sukkah and Lulav and Shofar, so she certainly can make a bracha of Amikra Megillah. She's obviously obligated, even if she's only obligated in the Pirsumei Nisa aspect, which would warrant the Shmoa Megillah, but that she's at least ahead of where she is when it comes to Sukkah. So why then did the Ramah say the bracha of Lishmoa Megillah should be said. I believe it's to reinforce the very point that we've been making. You make the bracha of Lishmoa Megillah in order to emphasize the fact that a woman is not obligated in Kriya, but only in Shmiya, so that a woman should not be reading the Megillah for a man. You mentioned last time there are some places where a woman reads the Megillah for a man. They say, look, two opinions in the Mechaber. We'll rely on the other opinion that a woman could read for a man. Simple interpretation of the Ramah that says the bracha of Lishma Megillah is said is to reinforce the position that is our custom that a woman is not obligated in Kriya, but only in Shmiya, the opinion of the Baal Halachas Gedolos, and to make sure that a woman's not going to read for a man, they insisted that she make the bracha of Lishma Megillah, even though she, in theory, could make a bracha on Mikra Megillah, the same as she could make a bracha of Leisha Besukha on the Tilas Lulav, or Lishma Kol Shofar, even though she's Psura completely. This is my explanation of the this particular minig that we have in the Ramah, that Lishma Megillah is recited. Now, I'm sure that there are some places where they don't follow the Ramah. They make on Mikra Megillah, so you have to follow the custom in your place. If there's no particular custom, since we are Ashkenazim, we should be following the minhag of the Ramah. As far as who should make the bracha, the better custom, according to many poskim, is that the woman should make the bracha. But if for some reason they can't, the man is reading, may recite the bracha for the women who are in the audience. Up to our last question. Question number 7. A former congregant asked me to be Masadik Kedushin for her, but it is in another community shul. I'm not comfortable doing it in the other Rav shul because it is not the chubah to the Rav. The Kala said, though, she wants to feel a connection to the marrying rabbi. She feels she has this with me, but not him. The Rav of the shul has already given her reshus, but should I decline? Should I co-officiate? Now, the word co-officiate is an interesting word. On a simple level, we talk about co-officiating means that people are under the chuppah, but it's traditionally only one Masada Kiddushin. He's the one who arranges the entire wedding, who makes the bracha, the two brachas, Hagofen and Mekada Sham Yisrael Dechubah of the Kiddushin. That's traditionally the Masada Kiddushin. So co-officiate is a broad general term. There's nothing wrong with co-officiating, but who is going to be the Masada Kiddushin? That's the big question. Again, colloquially, Masada Kiddushin, the one who was actually saying the brachas. I've been at some weddings where there's a quote Masada Kiddushin and someone else says the brachas. That's an unusual circumstance. But given the typical case, so we are left with this conundrum. I have to make a procedural point. Generally speaking, we assume it's the chosen who chooses the Masada Kiddushin. So here we're discussing the Kala. Maybe we're referring to a case where the chosen has no rav. We'll assume that for the moment, because otherwise it's really the chosen's decision, and maybe someone from neither of these two rabbis. But let's assume the chosen has no rabbi, and the kala is given the prerogative, and she has these two rabbis. If the rabbi of the local shul where the wedding is taking place gives reshus, it's certainly permissible for the rabbi from the other community to be the Masada Kiddushin. Absolutely permissible with reshus. Whether he should I decline, whether he should or should not, this is something which depends on the particular circumstances. Who exactly is the other Rav? Who is the Kala? What are the family like? I cannot answer this question in the broadest of terms. One needs to evaluate the specifics of the situation to know what to do. Generally speaking, if the Kala, or you can fill in the Chosen if it's appropriate, really, really wants you to be Masada Kiddushin, and the other rabbi is really, really sincerely gives you reshus, there's no reason not to do it. Unless perhaps the other rabbi is a much greater scholar, a Talmud Chacham, you feel it's some of a lack of covet for him as Talmud Chacham. But as far as him being the rabbi of the particular catering hall, because of course and logistical benefits is in that particular place, that does not give him such a standing, especially if I understand the question correctly, that the other rabbi is a rabbi in the same town. If a rabbi came from city A to city B to do the wedding, that is a little bit of a different question, because a rabbi in city B has a particular status of Mora D'Asri in his own community. The Ramah talks about it. We should try not to take that away. Although he gives reshus, it could be done under those circumstances. My time is up. I answered the questions as best I could. Rabbi Hammer, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi, very much. And if we can, invite Rabbi back in 2 weeks on March 12th again to answer the Shilas. We'd very much appreciate it.
And if people keep coming back and people want to ask questions, believe me, if I can, I'll try to be on that call as well.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye.